Into the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Tuesday, March 19th, 2013. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 284. So, if you're not getting bored of these, let's get the announcements out of the way really quick here. Of course, we have Porkfest 10 coming up, June 17th through 23rd, 2013, at the Rogers Campground in Lancaster, New Hampshire. If all goes as planned, I'll be speaking on Monday and on Friday, and the two topics I'll be covering is central planning versus spontaneous order, and discovering and defeating statist thinking. I'm not sure exactly which order that will be; those two lectures will be in, or talks, I should say. It's not really a lecture, but I'm not sure which will be on Monday and which will be on Friday, but time will tell. And the other one I want to mention, of course, is the Seacoast Annual Freedom Expo, which will be Saturday, April 27th, 2013, one day only, in Exeter, New Hampshire, at the Exeter Town Hall. It's, workshops, tables, setup, speakers, vendors, all day long fun and activities, and it's free. You don't have to sign up ahead of time. There's no admission fee whatsoever. You just show up and have fun at the Exeter Town Hall in Exeter, New Hampshire, April 27th, and have fun. I wish I could be there. I won't be there, but I wish I could be there. All right, so jumping right in here. Today I want to talk about lessons in logic and honesty. Yesterday I said that when Murray Rothbard involved himself in things like politics and with, you know, stuff like the Cato Institute and taking Coke money, Coke spelled K-O-C-H, not C-O-K-E, and certainly not referenced to any Central American cartels of any kind or any of that nonsense. But Murray took money from the Coke family, K-O-C-H, and how Murray failed to understand in doing all those things, it wasn't that he was doing anything dishonest or immoral in a sense of his intentions. He just misunderstood the nature of his enemy. He had a sort of a, what I would think is a muddled understanding between what I consider the government and the state, and he would refer to both interchangeably. So this seems inconsistent of Rothbard, especially when you sit down and read a masterful work like For a New Liberty, and you read that and you think, man, this guy has such a clear, concise picture of this whole situation, and then you see his actions and you think, well, that's inconsistent, and you might even doubt his honesty in it by seeing these actions. So I think it's imperative for all of us to self-examine constantly and to make sure that what we're saying and what we believe is consistent with our actions and consistent with the perceptions of our actions. Now, I'm not crazy about, public perception or about what other people think when they look at me or whatever. I'm not really big on any of that, as you can tell by pictures of me or if you've seen me in person. I don't care what other people think so much. But in the sense that what people think about our message and about our walk and about whether or not we have the testimony to stick with our walk, I've talked about this a few times. I'm often asked if I'm really a Quaker or not, and the answer is yes, and the answer is no. To a lot of Quakers, they would say, no, he's not a Quaker. He doesn't fit this criteria, A, B, C, and D. And in other ways, yes, I am a Quaker. I'm just not a very good Quaker at all, thus the name. But one concept I like to bring up in referencing Quakers, I was raised as a Baptist, And in a Baptist church or in a Baptist meeting, they'll often have a time where people give what they refer to as a testimony. And my longtime listeners have heard me explain this quite a few times, but so in a Baptist church, there will be a moment when people will either stand up from right where they're seated, or sometimes they'll go forward and go to the front of the auditorium or whatever. Sometimes they'll stand up on the podium, and they will tell some kind of some story or some little bit of information about themselves. And they will say how much they love God or how much Jesus has blessed them or whatever. And this will be their testimony. They get up and they publicly say words, and that's their testimony. Well, to a Quaker, a testimony is a thing completely different. It is the opposite of standing up and giving words. So, for example, I say, if I was to say, well, compare my testimony of truth, or compare my testimony of honesty, then what I would be asking the listener to do is to say, well, has Ben ever lied to me? Does Ben tell the truth, or does Ben lie? And so my act of not lying is my testimony. Not the fact that I stand up and say, I don't lie. That's not a testimony. The testimony to a Quaker is the actual working, the actual footwork of actually doing things in life and not lying about it. So if I'm saying, well, I don't lie, but then I sell you a boat with a hole in it, well, in every way, portraying the boat as being a good boat, then in essence, I have lied to you. If I knowingly sold you a boat with a hole in it, knowing that you assumed that it was a good boat, then even if I didn't openly express to you, hey, this is a real good boat, it doesn't have any holes, even if I didn't say that, I've expressed a mistruth to you. I've expressed something that wasn't, to my knowledge, factual. And therefore, my testimony of truth is of no value. I have completely thrown it away. So this is why I say that I don't really care what people think about me. You know, I walk around every day and people look at my hair, they look at my beard, they look at my size, and they come to all kinds of conclusions because of that. And most of those are negative, and I don't care. But, on the other hand, I care very much about my testimony of truth. Or, another Quaker might talk about their testimony of peace. And their testimony of peace might be expressed in the fact that they're a pacifist. Well, I'm not a pacifist. So that Quaker would say, well, Ben doesn't have a testimony of peace. Perhaps not. If somebody comes to my door and it's late in the evening and I've got a sign on my door that says, stay away and don't bother me, especially if you're selling something. And they come up and knock on the door and pretend they didn't see the sign, and I tell them to go away, that I don't want to buy anything, and they say, oh, I'm not selling anything, but what I'd like to tell you about this unique offer where you can give me money and we can do a service for you. Well, then my testimony of peace at a moment like that is pretty thin, because I'm very likely to come through the door and go right out into that person's face and physically usher them off of my property because they have irritated me to the point of violence. Now, I'm not saying that's good. I'm saying that's me. And so my testimony of peace to your average Quaker is not going to be so great. On the other hand, I think the average anarchist, who at least an anarcho-capitalist who believes in private property, would look at that and say, well, this person is trespassing. They're bothering you when you've asked politely not to be bothered. And they've put you in a position where you've basically got to throw them off your property. So the average ANCAP would say, yeah, that's not a matter of peace. That's a matter of protecting your property and standing up for what you own. So there's, in this situation, what testimony am I providing? Well, unfortunately for my fellow Quaker that's looking on, I don't care what you think. I'm defending my property. And to the ANCAP that might say, well, you're taking that to a bit of an extreme. I don't care. I'm defending my property. So when we take this out onto a wider thing, and we realize that we're giving a message to all the statists of the world and all the people who haven't quite, who don't really think about things like the government and the state and whether or not there's aggression, and they don't really think about these things on a day-to-day basis, Well, how we present this message, and again, I don't care what people think, but I care about what people think. You see, because when it's representing this message of ours, this message of zero aggression, and this message of freedom and liberty, liberty being the path to freedom, and the desire for freedom, then it's very important that we present a walk that is consistent with our talk. And in my mentioning Murray yesterday, I wasn't trying to attack Murray. I was just saying that Rothbard seems inconsistent, and the reason that he seems inconsistent is because I don't think he had a real clear understanding of what I describe as the difference between the state and the government. And as I was considering this yesterday and then again this morning, it got me thinking of an old Murray Rothbard David Friedman question. Murray had written up an article. There was a moment in time. Oh well, I'll just read a little bit of the beginning of the Murray's article. But essentially, Murray asked the question: "Do you hate the state?" And I had remembered reading Friedman's response, but you know, it just, for some reason, I couldn't bring it to mind and think, well, what did Friedman say about that? How did he respond to Murray's accusation? So I went back, and I carefully read both Murray's question in his article, "Do You Hate the State?" And I reread again, very carefully, David Friedman's answer to that question. And I'll put links in today's show notes to both Murray's question and on the same page that Murray's question appears was my original article where I took Murray's question and kind of gave it to Walter Block. So you can hear that that podcast on the same page where Murray's question is printed out. And then I will provide in today's show notes also a link to David Friedman's answer to that question. But before I get into that any further, let me read just a little segment of Murray's original question, or his original accusation, I should say. "There runs through For a New Liberty, and most of the rest of my work as well, a deep and pervasive hatred of the state and all of its works, based on the conviction that the state is the enemy of mankind. In contrast, it's evident that David does not hate the state at all, that he has merely arrived at the conviction that anarchism and competing private police forces are a better social and economic system than any other alternative, or more fully, that anarchism would be better than laissez-faire, which is in turn better than the current system. Amidst the entire spectrum of political alternatives, David Friedman has decided that anarcho-capitalism is superior, but superior to an existing political structure that is pretty good too." So that's the beginning of Murray's accusations against David Friedman. And David's defense, here's a little excerpt out of David's defense. And you really should follow the link in today's show notes and read Friedman's entire defense, because it wouldn't be right to just take, you know, this one little piece and maybe I'm taking it out of context or whatever. So get over and read it for yourself. The link is in today's show notes. So here's a little piece of Friedman's defense. "Rothbard's basic point is correct. I do not regard support for government as an act of willful evil, but as an intellectual mistake. My argument and his could be wrong, and some sort of government might be the least bad alternative among available human institutions. And even if we are correct, it is not unreasonable that other people, it is not unreasonable for other people to think we are not, as lots of intelligent people I know do. The flip side of that is that I think one consequence of his attitude was to make him willing to be deliberately dishonest in his argument, all being fair in war. That included being dishonest in the arguments he made to fellow libertarians." Then at that point, Friedman goes on to attack Rothbard's criticisms of Ronald Reagan, and he claims that Rothbard essentially lies or at least deceives in reference to Ronald Reagan. Now, there's a lot wrong in that little piece that Friedman wrote there, and I could probably do a whole podcast just taking that thing apart and showing what nonsensical babblings that it is. But just keep in mind that what he's saying here is he slightly agrees with Rothbard on what he called the basic point, that he does not regard, that he does not have a hatred for the state. But then he pulls a little trick here. He shows that agreement, and then he uses a basic sleight-of-hand distraction to avoid the real point in Rothbard's article. I call this the fart in the elevator defense. It's kind of like you're in an imagine yourself in an elevator, and there are two people discussing a point, and the one person is trying to make his point, and the other person is trying to counter that with their point, and the two are being civil, but they're disagreeing, and it gets to the point of where the one has the upper hand in their defense of their position, and the other is kind of left without a defense. So what they do is they very quietly, without any sound, put out a great big old fart and then point at their opponent and say, "Oh, how could you have done that? Oh, and then they jump out at the next elevator stop and leave the elevator with full of people and the person to deal with this accusation. And that's kind of what, that's the intellectual, what Friedman did is the intellectual version of the fart in the elevator defense. He pointed it, he first off kind of said, "Well, yeah, Murray might have a point about me not hating the state." And then he farts in the elevator and runs away. He completely distracted the point through a personal attack on Rothbard and changing the point. He switched it from, "Do I hate the state? What is the practical as opposed to moral outcome of this theory? How shall I think about it? And what way should we consider this?" He steps completely away from the argument that Murray was hoping to have and accuses Murray of being dishonest, being a liar, and changes it to an obscure economic argument about whether or not Ronald Reagan expanded or contracted the government. And see, there was nothing in Murray's article at all about Ronald Reagan. Sure, Murray's talked about Ronald Reagan. Who has lived through the Reagan years and hasn't talked about Ronald Reagan? So this is entirely a distraction. It's a personal attack and a distraction rather than facing the actual point of the article. Now, I should, in fairness, I should at least attempt to say what Rothbard's actual point was. There, let me just read this this next little section here. Rothbard says, Rothbard is talking about other great, people from earlier centuries that held a similar position to what Rothbard is holding, or at least laid the groundwork for what Rothbard believed. So he says, "And closer to our own day, such early influences on me as Albert J. Nock, H.L. Mencken, and Frank Charteroff were magnificently and superbly radical. Hatred of the hatred of our enemy, the state, and all of its works, shone through all of their writings like a beacon star. So what if they never made? So what if they never made it all the way to explicit anarchism? Far better for one Albert J. Nock than 100 anarcho-capitalists who are all too comfortable with the existing status quo." And so now we see the real accusation that Murray is making. He's saying, what's the use of taking a radical out-of-mainstream position and then going soft on the conclusion? What value does that do? When I come back, I want to talk more about practical as opposed to moral, and contrast the two and see if we can't see some kind of a logical progression that a person can take here. Stick with me, I'll be right back. BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com. Okay, so practical as opposed to moral. You know, if we live our life and we don't think about the morals, the moral implications of our actions, and we just think, well, let's see, what do I want today? And then you just do, you know, take whatever the shortest distance is to get the things you want today, and you don't put any kind of moral restrictions upon yourself, then essentially what you're going to be doing is waking up in the morning, going to your neighbor's house, robbing him of his breakfast, coming back to your house, eating it comfortably, thinking, oh, you know what, I'd like to watch some television. So you go back to your neighbor's house, and you steal his TV, and you come back and you watch some TV. Or maybe, you know, maybe it's easier just to kill your neighbor and watch the TV right there in his house and eat his food until you're tired of that and you want to go to some other neighbor's house and kill them. I mean, if you set your morals aside and you only go with what's practical and you don't worry about what the long-term effect of anything is, because I'll make the argument that if you follow the moral road, the long-term effect will be far better than if you follow the practical road without considering any morals. Whatever the long-term effect may be, it's always going to be worse than had you followed a moral path to begin with. And there's an odd thing in this that I've observed as well, and other people have said this too. It's not my original thing, but you know, in the short term, morals are always more difficult. They're always harder to deal with. They always, you know, cause more work, cause more effort. In the short term, morals are always the worst choice if you're just thinking practicality. But in the long term, morals are always the more consistent choice and producing a better result in the long run than abandoning morals and just going by what you want. So now, if we compare these two positions, the practical position or the moral position, the first thing I started thinking of when I was thinking about this was Hans Hermann Hoppe's wonderful work, A Theory of Socialism and Capitalism. And if you haven't seen that, you got to get your hands on that, because it's not that big, but it's a really foundational work in understanding the real core difference between socialism and capitalism. And it's not just a dry economics book. It's really good. Okay, so what Hoppe tells us in this book, and I've seen it said other ways, but I like the way Hoppe states it. He said that a moral is not derived from experience, but rather starts from a logically incontestable statement. Now, Hoppe explains that a logical incontestable statement is very different from an arbitrary postulated axiom. Okay, so a moral is not derived from experience, but rather starts from a logical incontestable statement and proceeds in a purely deductive way to results which are themselves logical, unassailable, and thus require no empirical testing whatsoever. So this is how you find a moral. This is how you I go by the natural law. The morals are in our mind already. We're born with them. But all we have to do is follow those things which we know are good and right. But sometimes we have to evaluate, am I on the right path? Self-evaluation, as I've said many times, is critical to living a moral life. So you begin to self-examine and you use this formula to see, am I perceiving morals as they really are? And so you take this thing apart in a purely deductive way and you find out, is this thing self-sustainable? Is it unassailable? Or am I off somewhere? So again, we have the short term and the long term, the practical and the moral. You could consider it as sort of an argument between should I rob a bank or should I grow a tomato. Well, robbing a bank is certainly easier than growing successfully growing tomatoes. You get the reward right now. It takes a few minutes, and your only real investment is a gun, and it will pay back that investment really quickly. Now, there's some slight danger involved, but mostly, if you're careful, there's very little actual danger involved in bank robbery. Most bank robberies are never solved unless the bank robber is a complete amateur and he's just an idiot and he, you know, like takes a cab to the bank and has the cab wait outside while he robs it or some stupid thing like that. But the vast majority of bank robberies are never solved if they're done by professionals because there's nothing difficult about it and it's relatively safe. So why aren't you robbing a bank? Why are you growing tomatoes? Well, the obvious reason is because in the long run, you're better off to work and to do good things and not aggress than to take the short route and just rob banks for a living. Because at some point in time, somehow it's going to catch up with you and your lifestyle is going to cause you to pay a price that you don't want to pay. So now let's get back to Rothbard's folly for a moment. He said, and by Rothbard's folly, I mean by him missing the point of the difference between the bigger entity of the state and the little thing that I refer to as government, which is just one aspect of the state. It's the muscle aspect of the state. So let's get back to his article about Friedman. He says, the difference is that the abolitionist always, and he's talking about abolishing the state, by the way, not talking about slavery here. The difference is that the abolitionist always holds high the banner of his ultimate goal, never hides his basic principles, and wishes to get his goal as fast as humanly possible. Hence, while the abolitionist will accept a gradual step in the right direction if that's all that he can achieve, he always accepts it grudgingly as merely a first step toward a goal which he always keeps blazingly clear. The abolitionist is a button pusher who would blister his thumb pushing a button that would abolish the state immediately if such a button existed. But the abolitionist also knows that, alas, such a button does not exist and that he will take a bit of the loaf if necessary while always preferring the whole loaf if he can achieve it. So, no, Murray, you're wrong. You're dead wrong. You're absolutely dead wrong. You see, again, this is a failure to understand the enemy, the very nature of that enemy that Murray hates so bad. By confusing how the state thinks, how it reacts, how it unfolds its destiny, and by misunderstanding the difference between the state and the government, Murray sees the problem as held within the structure of the government, and he never really understands that there is this entity that exists in the mind that's much bigger than the government. It's in a very real way, you can see Murray's confusion in something that, to a large extent, he gave birth to the argument or the movement of End the Fed. Long before anybody knew who Ron Paul was, you know, Murray was already saying, well, here's what the Federal Reserve is, here's what it does, here's why it's a bad idea, here's why it should be ended. The problem is, if we chant in the Fed, in the Fed, in the Fed until we're blue in the face, and eventually, you know, the Federal Reserve is going to fail in what it's doing because it's a Ponzi scheme to begin with. So when the government, I should say it like this, when the time comes that it becomes obvious to everyone that the Fed has failed and must be abolished, well, then what's going to happen? Well, you think government, even Murray Rothbard's naive vision of government, you think it's just going to go, well, bang, let's go ahead and let everybody be honest. No, the government is not going to just let go of the opportunity to grab more power. Why would it do that? At what point in time has the government ever acted that way? what the government is going to do, and it's because of the nature of the state that it will behave this way, the government is going to see that crisis as an opportunity to ratchet up its power. When the Federal Reserve finally gets to the point where the public demands that something be done, the government will use that crisis to make the situation worse by grasping more power. Now, this is not complicated stuff. So the more we hear, in the Fed, what you're really saying is, I want more government, I want more government. You think of that picture that's floating around all over the internet with the protesters on one side and the kid with his mouth wide open screaming at the cops and the cops on the other side of the line and the one cop with the can of mace spraying the kid right square in the face. And the caption points at the kid and says, wants more government. And the other caption points at the cop and says, more government. That's what you're doing when you call to end the Fed. You're trusting government to fix government. In doing so, you indicate that you have no knowledge of the nature of your enemy. You think your enemy just needs some slight adjustment. It's pretty good like it is now, but it could be a little bit better, maybe. You see, you're missing the entire nature of this beast that we're fighting against. You're taking, you know, Friedman's, what did he call it? The least bad alternative? The least bad alternative? I've heard people make the argument, well, if you're standing in an alley and there's a robber there, he's got a gun on you, and he says, okay, you know, you've got $100 on you. I'm going to rob 50 and give you 50 back. You want 50 back or you want 60 back? Well, I'm going to want 60 back. Well, I'm going to want to kill the robber. You see, whatever you get or don't get back from the robber is not the point. The point is you're being robbed. And to say that this is tolerable if you can just get some of your money back is illogical. But it's also illogical to think that you can convince the robber to rob you so little that you're not going to notice it, and to continue robbing you every day. Like, hey, Mr. Robber, look, I've got $100 on me, but I only need like 95 of it. How about if you only take $5 of my money today, but meet me here at this same spot tomorrow, I'll have another $100, and you can take 5 of that. And we'll do that every single day. All right, now we've got a tolerable robbery, right? He's not taking all your money at once. He's just going to meet you every day and take a little tiny bit. Wouldn't that be great? Well, that's what Murray just said when he said that, how did he put it? The abolitionist also knows that, alas, such a button does not exist, and that he will take a bit of the loaf if necessary, while always preferring the whole loaf if he can achieve it. And the other thing that Murray said was, he never hides his basic principles and wishes to get to his goal as fast as humanly possible. Well, again, let's take this back to morals. Do you want the fast path that sets aside morals, or do you want the long-term path that will better accomplish your goal and that will follow those morals? See, that's the question that Murray failed to address. No, I don't want that goal as fast as... If there was a button, let's just use Murray's example. If there was a button that I could push that would completely end, that would kill the state in all of its tentacles and all of its aspects and all everything about the state would just disappear if I just push this magic button, would you push the button? I would stay as far away from that button as possible. Do you know why? Because the state exists today because there's a market for the state. People want the state. People believe in the state. They need the state. They desire the state. The state gives them all kinds of things that they want. At least they perceive that it does. Whether it really does or not is not the point. They believe in the state. They want government to protect them from their evil neighbor. They want to be able to call the city and complain about that nasty neighbor down the street who has an ugly bush in his yard. They want to do that. They want that. They think that without the police driving down their street once a day, that they're somehow in danger. They think that the reason the robber doesn't kick in their door, kill them, and rob their house is because they have police. It never dawns on them that every day robbers walk right past the police station, kick in people's doors, kill them, rob them, and the police show up later and do paperwork. That never dawns on them. They never put those things together. But as long as there's a belief that these things that government provides, you know, you always hear roads. Oh, without government, who would build the roads? Well, who builds them now? People build them now. Contractors build them now. Who would do it in a society where there's no government? Contractors. Except there would be a profit motive. And so everything that they would do would, and people say, well, I don't want to drive on toll roads. Who owns the toll roads? Almost all toll roads are owned by government. You think about a private neighborhood, a private gated community owns its own roads. And you think about how much better those roads are than the ones out in the city. You see, so these arguments dissolve. But it's the perception that people have. They think there would be no roads without a government. They think there would be no security without the police. They think foreigners would come rushing across the borders of America. And, you know, how did that one idiot congresswoman say it? That marauders would come and burn and steal everything and take your business if it weren't for the fist of government right there protecting you all the time. Yeah, because, you know, there are just gangs of marauders hanging around waiting for the day that the police are looking the other direction. Well, in a sense there are. If you live in certain neighborhoods in the United States, there are gangs that are pretty aggressive. But the police can't stop them today. So it's all about perception, and it's all about all of these people believing that the state exists and that the state should exist, and that without the state, they wouldn't have all these wonderful things, even as far as things like Walmart or Kmart or, you know, any of those big, giant stores like that. People think, well, without the government, you know, we wouldn't have all these wonderful things. Well, you would have them, but you would have them in a different way. The government wouldn't be providing a forced monopoly in the sense of the way it protects corporations. So corporations wouldn't be able to pollute the way they do. They wouldn't be able to fix prices the way they do. And so the whole economic structure would be different. So if I push that button today and Walmart disappeared and your bank disappeared and all the military protections that you enjoy all disappeared and all of the, you know, the state parks would disappear and all the federal parks would disappear and immediately there would be a massive market for exactly what had gone away, but now people would be more desperate for it. So if there was a magic button like Murray describes that I could push and make all of government go away, even if I only included Murray Rothbard's view of government, if I could push that button and make all of government go away, tomorrow the market would bring back government that was far worse than I could imagine. Because that's what a revolution does. That's basically just a revolution. Murray Rothbard's button was nothing more than a call for revolution. But the revolution is always replaced by a worse government than they had before. So no, Murray, no. You're really going down the wrong path. I don't want a little piece of the loaf of bread. And I don't want... I don't want to push that button right now. I would not blister my thumb doing that. And it took me a long time to think this through and figure it out and realize that my previous position was wrong on this. I would not push that button because there's a market for the state. There's a market for government. And when a libertarian or an anarcho-capitalist goes against the market, holy cow, what are you thinking? Murray, what are you thinking? People want the government. What you have to do is provide a product that they prefer to the product that they're currently purchasing. That's the key. That's how we win this thing. Not by killing the government, not by getting involved in the government and trying to convince it to shrink itself. It's by providing an alternative that people look at in the marketplace and say, you know, product B is better than product A, and then product B wins. Stick with me, I'll be right back. From June 17th through June 23rd of this year, the Free State Project will celebrate its 10th annual Porcupine Freedom Festival, Porkfest. My wife Cindy and I plan on attending, and Bad Quaker staff members Hannah and Matt are trying to raise enough money to attend, as they did last year. Considering fuel, campground fees, and Porkfest tickets, we estimate it will cost BadQuaker.com a little over $2,000 for Cindy and I to attend. For Matt and Hannah to attend, it will cost about $700 more. If you'd like to take part in sending the Bad Quaker crew to Porkfest 10, here's how you can do it. Go to BadQuaker.com. You can click on the donate button on the right-hand side of the page. You can also give us bitcoins with our bitcoin number located right below the donate button, or you can use our Amazon button to shop at Amazon. If you'd like to support BadQuaker.com on a regular basis, you can use the link to our forum and become a supporting member for only $4 a month or just $25 a year. Thanks, folks. Now, I picked on Murray pretty heavily in that last segment, so just to be fair, let me go back and pick on David Friedman a little bit. You know, he mentioned the least bad alternative, that we should accept the least bad alternative. Well, when it comes to dealing with government, to accept the least bad alternative, that's basically, you know, you're deciding that you're going to go and you're going to sit yourself dead center in the middle of the enemy's camp and eat his bread at his table with his blessing when you do that. That's what you've done. That's what you've decided. You've decided that, freedom would be great, but you know what's not so bad is being a slave. Being a slave is okay as long as I'm not beaten today. Or maybe if I'm only beaten now and then. That's tolerable. That wouldn't be so bad. I can handle being beaten once or twice. If I get, if I get bread, it's bread. I got bread. Well, that's not so bad, is it? I can tolerate bread. That's the least bad alternative. I still get bread. Sure, I get beat, but I got bread. Hey. Well, I think that's a pretty goofy position. I think Friedman's position is really, there's no functional difference between Friedman's position and that of Nancy Pelosi and Rush Limbaugh. Because if you put yourself in Nancy Pelosi's mind, if you put yourself in Nancy Pelosi's shoes, let's put it that way, she really believes a lot of what she pushes. She believes she's doing good. She believes that she's fighting for the least bad alternative. She actually believes that. The question is, who's right about what's the least bad alternative? David Friedman? Nancy Pelosi? Rush Limbaugh? Does it matter? All of these are compromises, and all of these are accepting the slavery for the bread. That's all you're doing. Whether you're in Rush Limbaugh's shoes, or whether you're in Nancy Pelosi's shoes, or whether you're in David Friedman's shoes, really, you've taken the same functional position. You are compromising on core principles for the purpose of practicality. You're choosing practical over moral. That's really what you're doing. And really, so what we're talking about here in this spectrum between Friedman, Pelosi, and Limbaugh, what we're talking about here is differences in degree, but not differences in kind. So Friedman's position, Nancy Pelosi's position, and Rush Limbaugh's position are exactly in kind, but they differ in degree. Friedman would like to see one amount of liberty, whereas Nancy Pelosi would like to see a different level of liberty. There are things that Nancy Pelosi, there are aspects of liberty that Nancy Pelosi holds precious to her. And then you have Rush Limbaugh, who has other degrees that he holds important. So we have, if you look at the spectrum between Pelosi, Friedman, and Limbaugh, you, like I said, you have the same kind. They're all the same kind. They're just varying of degree within that scope. So if we think about, let's go back to what I was talking about, lessons in logic and honesty. If we think about the difference in kind and degree, difference in kind and the difference in degree. So why is it important to understand this difference? Because taking a moral position and defending that position using logic is only as effective as the method we use to explain that position. So, for example, if you think about coercion, and you compare coercion to voluntary association. So let's think of the difference between a stalker and a friend. You have a stalker, and what is it? What's the actual activity that the stalker does? Well, everywhere you go, the stalker is there also. And when you talk, the stalker wants to hear you. And when you go someplace else, the stalker will follow you. Now, how is that different from a friend? If you have a close friend, and you like that friend, and you have a voluntary association with that friend, and that friend likes to go places with you, and likes to hear what you have to say, and when you're in one place and you go to another place, that friend likes to follow you and go to that place as well. So what do we have here? We have a difference in kind, but in a sense we have no difference in degree. They're doing the same thing. It's just that one is a stalker. Their activity is based on weird creepiness and maybe is dangerous and is definitely not based on voluntary association. But then with the friends, we have something that has no coercion, no aggression, no force. You're just friends. You're choosing voluntarily to associate with each other. Okay, so now going along the same lines, you'll hear a lot of people in the liberty, liberty-oriented people will refer to tax as it's like rape. Tax is like rape. Well, the problem is when you just blurt that out like that, you kind of sound crazy. The vast majority of the people out there who hear you say that tax is like rape, they're going to think you're crazy. Now, actually, tax and rape are just varying degrees in the same kind. And by that, it's not that hard to explain if you go through slowly and you think about it, okay? Well, let's consider rape and love. Rape and love are functionally very similar, but they're vastly different because they're two strictly different kinds of things. One involves aggression, coercion, force, harm, while the other involves voluntary association, love, relationship, and it's beautiful. You see, you have a horrible thing and a beautiful thing that are functionally the same. It's just one is bad and one is good. Well, so when you think about tax, tax is aggression. Tax is to approach someone and take something from them whether they agree to it or not. And take it ultimately at the point of a gun. Now, a lot of times when you make the reference that taxation is at the point of the gun, since people like Stefan Molyneux who says all the time, people don't see the gun, therefore they don't realize the gun. But of course we understand that if you don't pay your taxes, then first they're going to send you a letter, and if you ignore the letter, or if you don't obey the letter, they're going to send you another letter, and eventually they'll stop sending you letters, and they'll send a guy to your house in a costume carrying the letter. And if you continue to not pay your tax, eventually they'll send a group of guys in costume, and they'll take you away. And if you resist, they'll kill you. So tax, in that sense, is like rape. If you consider tax as opposed to charity, then tax is like rape, and charity is like love. So when you explain this, it makes sense. But if you just blurt it out that tax is like rape, then you haven't explained the difference between kind and degree. So tax and rape are similar in kind, and love and charity are similar in kind. We're just talking about different degrees here. And as you're thinking of these things, you have to keep in mind that what we're talking about is there's this stunning level of ignorance in the general public. And I need to, I use the word ignorance because there's no other word that fits as well as ignorance. The problem is with the word ignorance, it's often misunderstood. People think when you say ignorant, you're talking about dumb or stupid, or it's the derogatory form. And so, well, no, I'm ignorant of a lot of things. I'm ignorant of a lot of aspects of physics. I'm ignorant of certain, you know, math equations. I'm ignorant of what life is like in certain places in the world. Ignorance is a lack of knowledge and or understanding. It doesn't mean you're stupid. And if we look out across the world and we look at people on a day-to-day basis that we come in contact with, there is just a stunning level of ignorance when it comes to using logic and thinking these things out, you know, thoroughly. Whether we're talking about differences in kind and differences degree, or whether we're talking about, you know, moral as opposed to practical, there's a stunning amount of lack of understanding and lack of thought. And it's really it's probably the biggest single thing that restricts us in expressing liberty to people. You know, I talked about this not long ago, I think, where if you had a whole bucket full of iPhones and you could just drop into like the 15th century or something, and even if those iPhones were perfectly functional, and even if there were cell towers in place to give them, you know, so again, so they're perfectly functional, you couldn't sell an iPhone to anybody at any price. Nobody would want one. Why would they want that? Doesn't make a good hammer. You can't eat it. It doesn't help, you know, milk the cow. It's not a very good shovel. Why would I want this iPhone? It's you have to educate people in order for them to want the product that you have. And again, our stumbling block, whether you're selling iPhones in the 15th century or whether you're selling liberty in the 21st century, your stumbling block is the general ignorance of the public. And a really good example of this, up in the Free State Project, the folks up in New Hampshire have shined a lot of light on this topic by exposing the levels of ignorance that are available to us in the general public. And I think of, you know, Derek Jay's Victimless Crime Spree, that movie. He does a really good job of showing the general ignorance of people when he's just behaving normally and they get all bent out of shape with him. There's this one scene in there that I just really think is hilarious, but it's sad. It's horrible sad at the same time. He's on a sidewalk, which is, you know, considered, using their rules and their terminology, it's public property, a sidewalk. Anybody can walk up and down a sidewalk. So he's on a sidewalk, and he's in front of a school, which is also public property. And he is he has his camera out, and he's just doing some filming work, and he's filming at a distance a crossing guard who is a public employee. Now, according to the rules that the government gives us, public, so-called public property, is you know, open to the public, and public employees can, according to the rules of the government, can be filmed. It's not against the rules; they can be filmed. And so this crossing guard notices him filming her, and she, an old lady, you know, that ought to know better than this, she turns around, runs at Derek, hits him with her sign, and then claims that he's being aggressive with her. And all he did was say hi to her. I mean, literally, all he did was say hello. And she comes running at him and hits him with her sign. And she tries to then claim that that he's on private property. And she doesn't understand that she's a public employee. And she doesn't understand that she just assaulted him. I mean, she literally, you can tell by her reaction to this, she doesn't think that she did anything wrong in hitting him with the sign. She thought she was defending herself by running at him and hitting him with her sign. Now, this is layers of ignorance. This is not that she's a bad person. It just means she's really, really ignorant of basic human functions, and she's unaware, completely ignorant, of the actual laws that make her employment possible and that make day-to-day life in America possible under the fist of a government. She's completely ignorant to those things. And that, you know, that's just one example that's there in Derek J's victimless crime spree. And honestly, well, one other example. Here's just one other example. We have a situation in New Hampshire where, I don't know if it's still there or not, but it was for a long time. One of the free staters up there was actually banned from going to the courthouse. He had a restraining order against him saying that he couldn't go to the whole courthouse. Now, how can you have a court issuing a ban for someone to come to the public property, which is the courthouse? How do you even file an appeal against something like that? How do you find out about it? How do you? That's crazy. That's without regress. That's going back to, you know, Magna Carta stuff. That's just ridiculous. And it's all based on the ignorance of the judge. The judge was just that ignorant of law and of reason and of property, and didn't think it through and thought that was a good idea. Or he's a jerk. That could be possible, too. So there are people in life that we can reach through careful, logical steps. But there are lots of people who simply can't be reached. You know, remember that quote from the Matrix movie where he said, you have to understand that some of these people are not ready to be unplugged. There's many of them that are so injured and so hopelessly dependent on the system that they'll fight to protect it. Well, that's what we have. That's what I'm talking about with Murray's button there. We can't just push the button. We certainly can't, you know, convince government to push the button. The government is certainly going to commit suicide, but they're not going to do it intentionally. You know, the state will die at some point in time, but it's not going to die of its choice, and it's going to thrash violently before that takes place. So let's get back just for a moment to the difference between kind and degree. You think about something like driving skills. Okay, so the government just makes an arbitrary age. They say at 15 and a half, and it changes from state to state, but they say at 15 and a half you can get a learner's permit and you can begin to learn how to drive. Well, now, how do we come up with that date? How do you know, or that age, I mean, how do you know that some people would be really good drivers at 12 and other people are never going to be good drivers even when they're 35 or 45 or 55? How do you make that kind of an arbitrary judgment? You see, what we're talking about here is a difference between degree and kind. You either have good drivers or bad drivers, and you have this weird arbitrary decision for an age where you draw that line, and you don't take into effect the actual degree of difference between good drivers and bad drivers. You just draw a line and say, well, there it is, age 15, you can start learning. Prior to that, you can't even learn. That's the kind of illogical things that we see from the state on a daily basis. So this is the way government thinks. This is the way the state influences people to think on all levels. But this is definitely the way government thinks. The state influences through government schools, through the media, through corporations, through all these different ways. But the state teaches people to think of, you know, how do you obtain cultural change, whether we're talking about changing government or getting more liberty or less liberty. The government, the state thinking causes us to think, well, there are two ways. There's violence and there's the political means. That's how you get things done, through the political means or through violence. But these are the same thing. This is the same kind. It's just different levels of violence. So anytime you're using the political means, you're using violence. You're using violent aggression. So that's what, when we talk, you know, I've talked about Franz Oppenheimer, the political means by its very nature is immoral and ineffective. And using the violence of using violence on any level to oppose the state on any level or to try to change government. And again, the political means is violence. It's aggression. So using the political means to try to obtain your goals in and of itself is immoral. And it's our primary responsibility to embrace the practices of liberty, like agorism, voluntary exchange, zero aggression principle, these things, these words that we throw out, voluntary association. But it's also, it's our responsibility to live these things and to live the ideas of liberty and allow that to be an educating tool for everyone. Allow that to be our testimony to what liberty really is. Not just words, but the actual outworking of that. So we can't force liberty on the world through political means. And we can't conquer the state through force of arms. And we can't work within the system because the use of the system is the very thing we have to stand against. We can only teach those who seek and offer a better system when the market is ready for that system. And now how will this stop the state? Well, we don't have to stop the state. The state's going to kill itself at some point. All we have to do is stay out of its way, stay out of its reach. Don't be a victim of it. We have to educate others and live as an example. We have to promote agorism. We have to sever our dependence from the state in every way possible. And the main thing we have to keep in mind is to never fight the market. As long as there's a market for the state's going to continue. We have to create an alternative to that market if we want to win. So in the Fed by political means, are you serious? Are you really serious in the Fed? Chant that until it comes, and then what do you have? How about in the state by economic means, not by political means, by economic means? Let the market kill the state. How would that be? Thanks for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.